According to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Centers for Environmental Information, in 2020 alone, the U.S. experienced $22 billion weather and climate-related disasters. A weather or climate event doesn't have to produce $1 billion in damage to have a story, so I've decided to tell a few of my personal storm and disaster stories. And along the way, I've recruited friends and family to share their stories. And now I'm recruiting you, the listener, to share your stories. Welcome to Caught in the Fury. In mid-September 2008, Hurricane Ike did $38 billion in damage across the Caribbean, the U.S., and Canada before impacting Iceland. Yes, you heard that correctly. And it finally dissipated about 2.5 weeks after its formation. From its first landfall in the Bahamas, to two landfalls in Cuba, and a final landfall as a hurricane in Texas, Ike brought death and destruction in a 450-mile-wide swath. While about 1 million Americans evacuated Ike's path, over 100,000 stayed behind to ride out the storm. Today I talked to my friend Brittany, who rode out the storm in Houston, about why she stayed, and her experience during what was at the time the second costliest hurricane in U.S. history. And just as a note, I'll be using UTC, which is Universal Coordinated Time, and that's 5 hours ahead of Central Time. I'm going to try and give local times as well, just to give you guys an idea of when the storm was impacting areas, so you can kind of get an idea of what people might normally be doing, like sleeping, as the hurricane was impacting areas. Since hurricanes are multiple-day events, I feel like this context is important. Today's content warning is mostly for language. We get a little salty in the interview, so if that's not your thing, it's cool. It's just who we are. Hashtag sorry, not sorry. Since there were such large, far-reaching impacts of this storm, I'm not going to be able to get as in-depth as I did with Andover. I'm not saying that there aren't plenty of impactful stories. I just don't have time to do them justice, so I'm not going to half-ass it. In the words of Ron Swanson, I'm going to haul ass one thing, which is the main part of this episode. Before we get started, I want to go over a couple of things for those of us that might be less familiar with hurricanes. I want to talk about the practice of naming storms, and I want to get a little bit into the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale. The practice of naming Atlantic tropical storms and hurricanes began in 1953 and replaced a somewhat confusing practice of identifying storms by latitude and longitude. Prior to that, they were named for the area they impacted, such as the Galveston hurricane of 1900, which I will talk about a little bit. Through the 1950s, the 60s, and much of the 70s, hurricanes were given only women's names. By 1978, both men's and women's names were used. Today, we use a list of 21 alternating men's and women's names, with the list repeating every seventh year. And 21 names are used because some letters are too difficult to find six or more names for. So for example, if we use a name in 2021, like I think the last one was Hurricane Elsa, that name won't see use again until 2027. And if a storm is particularly costly or has a large impact, the name will be retired to reduce confusion and out of sensitivity to those affected. So names like Katrina, Laura, Andrew, Camille, and Ike, they'll never be used again. So what happens if there's more than 21 named storms in a season? That's an excellent question, and it's actually happened a couple of times. I think the first time it happened was in 2005, and then most recently it happened in 2020. So they kind of had a practice where when they would hit the last letter, they would roll over to the Greek alphabet. And since 2020 saw us 9 letters deep into the Greek alphabet, they've kind of gone back and revised how they are going to handle more than 21 named storms in a season going forward. So with Iota being that 30th named storm, they kind of got together and they said from 2021 on, additional storms are going to be named from an alternate list that's been approved by the World Meteorological Organization. The practice of naming these hurricanes is to help the public, since there are often multiple tropical storms and hurricanes ongoing at the same time in various places across the Atlantic. While hurricanes, cyclones, and typhoons do affect more than just the Atlantic, I'm only focusing on the Atlantic practices at this time because that's the area that I'll be discussing in this episode. The Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale was developed in 1971 by Herbert Saffir, a civil engineer, and Robert Simpson, a meteorologist and a former director of the National Hurricane Center. By 1974, it was in widespread use. Today, both the Atlantic Basin and the North Pacific east of the International Dateline use this scale to discuss hurricanes. Unlike the Fujita and Enhanced Fujita scale, this tool is exclusively based on wind speed and doesn't include storm surge, rainfall, barometric pressure, or even the size of a storm to determine categories. So it's not taking into account some of the most damaging effects of a hurricane. As we'll see today, a Category 2 may not be considered major based on wind speed alone. So if you're hearing a call to evacuate, it's best to heed those warnings. The Saffir-Simpson scale bases its categories on calculating wind speeds and then averaging a 1 minute sustained wind to categorize that hurricane strength. And before I get into it, I do want to briefly explain tropical depressions and tropical storms, which are relevant, though they aren't included on this list. Tropical depressions are low pressure systems and storms with 1 minute sustained wind speeds of less than 38 miles per hour. Tropical storms have winds between 39 and 73 miles per hour. And once a storm reaches this designation, it gets a name. Often hurricanes grow out of one, sometimes both of these types of storms. They may begin life as depressions and get enough warm, unstable air sucked into them to grow into full-fledged hurricanes. So now that we know a little bit about tropical storms and tropical depressions, let's get into the Saffir-Simpson scale. Category 1 hurricanes have a 1 minute sustained wind between 74 and 95 miles per hour. And often in these storms, we see very dangerous winds that will produce some damage. Usually no significant structural damage occurs, although unanchored mobile homes can be knocked over, weak trees can be uprooted, coastal flooding and pier damage can happen, and widespread power outages that last several days are possible. Category 2's pack winds between 96 and 110 miles per hour and have extremely dangerous winds that will cause extensive damage. Poorly constructed doors and windows, as well as roofing materials, can be damaged, which can expose the structure of the roof. Signs and piers with poor construction can have considerable damage. Many trees will be damaged or uprooted, and small boats and unprotected anchorages may break their moorings. Mobile homes, anchored or not, they can be damaged or destroyed, and even manufactured homes can sustain structural damage. Extensive to near total power outages with scattered loss of potable or drinkable water are likely and could last many days. Now we get to what are classified as major hurricanes. Category 3 hurricanes with winds between 111 and 129 miles per hour will cause devastating damage. Now we start to see some structural failures, especially to small residences and utility buildings on the curtain wall, which are exterior non-load-bearing walls, so like walls with large windows. Homes with gabled roofs, which are roofs that have two sides that meet down the center, those gabled roofs are peeled off. Manufactured homes see significant to irreparable damage, and mobile homes are outright destroyed. Flooding near the coast will destroy smaller structures, and it will hammer larger structures with floating debris. There is a video from, I think, Katrina, and I think it was taken in Gulfport, of the storm surge from the hurricane picking up a car and then using that car and hammering against the front doors of that hotel repeatedly until the glass doors finally break, and then all this water rushes in and it carries the car down the hall. And it's crazy. If I can find the short version of this, I will link it in the show notes. Even terrain well inland can flood. Large numbers of trees are uprooted or snapped, and this will isolate affected areas. Near total to total power loss is likely for up to several weeks, and water is likely to be lost or contaminated. Category 4 hurricanes have winds between 130 and 156 miles per hour, and they will cause catastrophic damage. Some small residences may see a complete structural failure, heavy or irreparable damage to gas station canopies, and other wide-span overhang-type structures are common. And at this point, both mobile and manufactured homes are flattened. Most trees are uprooted or broken, and this isolates many areas. Extensive beach erosion occurs, and it can happen with flooding that extends far inland. Power outages and water loss are expected to be total and long-lived, possibly for many weeks. Category 5s have winds over 157 miles per hour and are a continuation of the catastrophic damage with an increase in severity. Complete roof failures of many residences and industrial buildings with complete building failures of small utility buildings are seen. Widespan roofs with no interior support collapse. So places like Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's. Heavy to irreparable damage occurs to many wood frame structures, and total destruction of mobile and manufactured homes is prevalent. Structures that are capable of surviving are often 3 to 5 miles inland and are constructed of steel and concrete frames. So these are like office buildings, condo and apartment buildings, or parking garages. There are some house styles that are likely to survive, and they're typically concrete block construction with roofs that have no overhangs. And the roof will have 4 sides that meet in the middle, and they'll have a very shallow pitch. So that means the height of the roof from the top of the wall to the top of the roof is really shallow. And basically that doesn't give the hurricane anywhere to push against or anywhere for the wind to get under to rip that roof off. And if a structure can keep its roof, it fares a lot better, because once the roof is gone, there's really nothing to hold the walls up. These structures also, they have shutters or they have hurricane resistant safety glass, which I just learned is a thing, and watching it being tested is fascinating. So you're welcome. Flooding in a Category 5 storm causes major damage, and many structures near the shore can be washed away or completely flattened by storm surge. Virtually all trees are uprooted, snapped, or even debarked, which isolates most affected communities. Massive evacuations are often required in areas in the path of a Category 5. Total and extremely long-lived power outages and water loss are expected and may last several months. So now that I have some of the background out of the way, let's get into Hurricane Ike and its journey through the Caribbean and into the United States and Canada. At the end of August 2008, a storm system moved into the Atlantic Ocean off the west coast of Africa. As it strengthened, it reached tropical depression status at 6 a.m. UTC on September 1st, and 6 hours later strengthened to a tropical storm. As the 9th named storm of the season, it was designated Tropical Storm Ike, following Hurricane Hanna and taking a path through the Caribbean similar to Hurricane Gustav, which had impacted roughly the same area just 8 or 9 days prior. By about 6 p.m. UTC on the afternoon of September 3rd, the storm would officially become Hurricane Ike. Following explosive growth over open water and favorable atmospheric conditions, Ike was reclassified into a major hurricane with 115 mile per hour sustained winds just 3 hours after reaching hurricane status. 6 hours after becoming a hurricane, Ike had strengthened into a Category 4 with 135 mile per hour winds. 4 days later, on September 7th, it made its first landfall. From what I've been able to find, there seems to be some disagreement on where Ike's first recorded landfall was. I'm going to go with what I'm seeing on the National Weather Service, and their official first landfall for Hurricane Ike was on Great Inagua, which is in the southern part of the Bahamas. Though the now Category 4 storm did heavily impact the Turks and Caicos Islands a few hours prior to that, on Grand Turk, power was completely lost, and about 95% of homes on the island, as well as its neighbor South Caicos, were damaged. At 1 p.m. UTC, which would be roughly 9 in the morning local time, Ike, now a Category 3, would plow across the island of Great Inagua, damaging about 75% of the island's houses, and severely damaging or destroying roughly 25% of them, before strengthening again into a Category 4. By midnight UTC, 8 p.m. local time on the 8th, It would roar onto the coast of Cuba at Cabo Lucretia, about 500 miles east-southeast of Havana. From here, the hurricane would make its way across the island and back over the ocean, now south of the island. It would spend the next day tracking along the southern coast of Cuba, sometimes as close as 12 miles to shore, before making its second landfall on the island as a Category 1 at around 2 p.m. UTC, or 10 a.m. local time. On the 9th of September, near Punta La Capitano, which is 60 miles southwest of Havana. During this period, Ike was producing tropical storm force winds as far away as the Florida Keys. Then Florida Governor Charlie Crist issued a disaster declaration on the 5th of September, which included the Keys and prompted mandatory evacuations for tourists starting the following day from Key West to Key Largo. This was due in part to early predictions that had shown Ike to possibly impact the Keys and the east coast of Florida. After leaving Cuba behind, a severely weakened Ike would continue its westward path. September 10th, it would encounter the warm loop current between Cuba, the Yucatan Peninsula, and the U.S. Gulf Coast, and begin to strengthen one last time. At this time, it would set its sights on the Texas coast and Galveston Island. Over the loop current, Ike's barometric pressure would plummet, pulling warm water toward the storm's eye and allowing it to feed off the moist tropical air created by the Gulf's waters. The water Ike would pull in would go on to spell disaster for the Texas and Louisiana coastline. As Ike was gaining strength over the loop current, then President George W. Bush would make an emergency declaration for Texas in order to free up more help at the federal level to assist with preparations and evacuations. The following day, as forecasts began to show Ike taking aim on Galveston, Texas, the city began issuing mandatory evacuations for low-lying areas on the island. They would go on to issue mandatory evacuations starting at noon on the 11th for the entire island of Galveston and low-lying parts of Houston, as well as Jefferson and Orange and Chambers counties to the east of Houston. What's important to understand here is that Ike happened just 3 years after Katrina, during a hurricane season that would also include Hurricane Rita, a monster Category 5 that would prompt evacuations in some of these same areas of Texas and cause a massive headache and traffic nightmare, as between 2.5 and nearly 4 million people attempted to get out of Rita's path. With the memory of Rita's evacuation frustrations still very fresh in the minds of Texans, and Ike's designation as a Category 2 hurricane, it's easy for me to see why over 100,000 decided to shelter in place rather than evacuate. Around 8 p.m. on September 11th, the National Weather Service in Houston and Galveston would issue a strongly worded bulletin concerning storm surge around Galveston Bay. It advised that residents of some parts of coastal Texas faced certain death if they chose not to evacuate. Officials even went so far as to tell residents that chose not to evacuate to write their name and social security number on their arm with permanent marker in order to be able to identify their bodies. In spite of these chilling warnings, as much as 40% of Galveston's population would not heed warnings. Areas like Port Arthur and low-lying areas between Morgan City, Louisiana, and Baffin Bay, Texas, were feared to be much the same in terms of evacuating. And it was a source of major concern, particularly areas east of Ike's projected landfall, which were predicted to experience storm surges of up to 20 feet. At 7 a.m. UTC, 2 a.m. local time on September 13th, time was up for residents of Galveston. Ike churned ashore near the Bolivar Peninsula, a barrier island just to the north of Galveston Island, and it was packing winds of 110 miles an hour and storm surge near 20 feet. At this point, Ike's winds are a strong Category 2, almost Category 3, and the storm surge it brought was on par with a Category 5 hurricane. Though Galveston's seawall at 17 feet high would spare many homes and businesses in central Galveston during Ike's initial landfall, the geography of Galveston Bay and the low pressure of Ike's eye would cause the waters of the bay to slosh, wreaking further havoc on Galveston and the Bolivar Peninsula, as water pushed ahead of the eye would hit the coast of mainland Texas and then be pushed back into the bay and the barrier islands, causing flooding behind the seawall. Many homes, businesses, and piers would be completely washed away. On NASA's website, there are some really good satellite images of what Galveston looked like before and after the storm, and the differences are stark. Though Galveston and surrounding coastal areas took the brunt of the storm's eyewall, Houston would be fairly lucky when it came to Ike. As Ike plowed into the Texas coast and further inland, Ike set its sights firmly on Houston, a metropolis of over 2 million. Due to the geography of the city, mostly flat with very few places for water to drain, Ike had the potential to be catastrophic for the city. The Harris County Flood Control District listed wind gusts of over 90 miles per hour at Hobby Airport, which is about 7 miles from downtown Houston. Between 9 and 20 inches of rain would fall in the area, flooding downtown and blowing out windows and high-rises like the J.P. Morgan Chase Tower, and the streets below would be littered with glass and other debris. About 2.2 million residents of Houston would lose power, with some places being out of power for over a month. But because Ike's rain bans didn't linger, the flooding it caused was mercifully much less than it could have been. And I'll kind of touch on this some more in a later episode when I talk to one of my friends that went through Hurricane Harvey in 2017. Ike would finally begin a turn to the north and east near Palestine, Texas, which is about 100 miles southwest of Dallas, and it would weaken into a tropical depression around Dallas before eventually becoming an extratropical cyclone and dumping rain from the Midwest through Montreal. Homes in the St. Louis area were damaged by hurricane-like conditions, and cities like Cincinnati and Columbus saw wind gusts of up to 75 miles per hour as this system moved through. Damage in Ohio exceeded $1.1 billion, and it tied for the costliest storm in the state's history with the 1974 Xenia tornado. It seems wherever Ike went, disaster declarations followed. Disaster declarations in the U.S. that were related to Ike went from the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast all the way into Kentucky and Ohio. Power outages with the storm stretched from the Caribbean to Canada. Humidity from Ike's remnants actually caused electrical issues in Montreal, which temporarily shut down part of the city's subway system. It also brought somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 inches of rain to parts of Ontario. By September 17th, the low-pressure system left over from Ike's rampage would combine with another depression and bring nearly 8 inches of rain to the Reykjavik area in Iceland, causing 30-foot swells off of the southwest coast of the country, and it would pack wind gusts of nearly 90 miles per hour, causing a dust storm on the northern part of the island. As bad as Ike was for the Gulf Coast of Texas, it could have been much worse. In 1900, Galveston was mostly at or below sea level, and it was on track to become one of the largest cities in the U.S. It was booming as a deep water port. Its closest rival was Houston, and they were over a decade away from having a port of their own. But a large city with many residents living at or below sea level, in an area where hurricanes happen, is a recipe for disaster. In September of 1900, Galveston's luck would run out as a Category 4 did its best to wipe the island and its inhabitants off the map. It would nearly succeed. With little to no ability to warn residents ahead of the storm, Galveston had very little time to evacuate, or even prepare. Homes were inundated by storm surge, wind and water laid waste to the area, and hundreds were swept into the Gulf. Official tallies would list 8,000 dead, although the reality is probably far higher. The reason I mention the storm is that it took a very similar path to Ike, tracking over much of the same area. Ike was not the area's first rodeo when it came to hurricanes, nor is Ike likely to be its last. As a result of the 1900 storm, the island of Galveston was raised by several feet in a process that pumped slurry from the bottom of Galveston Bay onto the island, and a seawall was put up to protect residents in the event of future hurricanes. Later storms like Rita would see improvements made in how officials called for evacuations and how they worded warnings. But no matter how well prepared emergency responders or local and state officials are, and no matter how many improvements are made, human beings are still very much human. And Mother Nature will still find ways to surprise and sometimes baffle us. The realities of Ike were stark. It left almost 200 dead in its wake, 74 in Haiti already reeling from multiple hurricanes that season, another 7 in Cuba, still recovering from Hurricane Gustav just 9 days prior. 2 deaths in the Dominican Republic were directly attributed to the storm, and another 113 were killed in the U.S. As of 2011, 16 of those were still listed as missing. As of September 13th of 2008, The highest storm surge had been noted at Sabine Pass at 22 feet, and it was the highest surge ever recorded at that station. It also broke the record for greatest storm surge ever seen with a Category 2 hurricane. On the Bolivar Peninsula, just east of Ike's landfall on Galveston Island, most of the area was completely submerged under the storm tide, with water from the Gulf rising over the first floor of many homes. Many piers along Galveston Island were completely destroyed. The historic Balinese Room, a former mafia-run nightclub that stood on an elevated pier that once extended about 600 feet into the Gulf, had withstood many storms before, but was completely swept away as Ike turned ashore over Galveston Island. The famed venue had hosted performers ranging from Frank Sinatra and Bob Hope, George Burns to Groucho Marx and Sammy Davis Jr., and had at the time been recently renovated following years of neglect and was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The wooden piers, which Galveston had been well known for, didn't survive Ike's fury at landfall. Murdoch's Pier, the 61st Street Pier, and the 91st Street Pier were all destroyed, though they have since been rebuilt. Murdoch's Pier was reopened in October of 2009, the year following Ike. The 61st Street Pier reopened the year following that in 2010. After the storm, Seawall Boulevard, which runs the length of the seawall and sits above several popular beaches along the Gulf, was choked with debris of these and many other structures. The 91st Street Pier, which was formerly a two-story house-like structure that extended about 400 feet into the Gulf of Mexico, was where three residents opted to ride out the storm, despite dire warnings from both the National Weather Service and local officials, warnings that they faced certain death. I'm fairly certain that their story featured in the Weather Channel's Storm Stories episode on Ike, which is worth a watch. About 3 hours ahead of Ike's landfall, they called local emergency operators to request evacuation, since the entire first floor of their shelter, in addition to much of the pier, had already fallen into the Gulf. Due to the rising wind and water, the risks of rescue were deemed unacceptable to first responders and rescuers. Ultimately, the trio would ride out the storm, huddled inside what was left of the pier's second floor, before being airlifted to dry land by a Coast Guard helicopter the following morning. 940 were rescued from the water, with nearly 2,000 rescued after the storm subsided. Some survivors escaped the rising water during the storm by knocking holes in their attics, by climbing to rooftops or trees. Some used nearby boats or floated on debris until finally reaching solid ground or other rescue. Storm Stories also featured an interview with Crystal Beach resident and Coast Guard veteran Mark Davidson, who escaped his home after it was completely lifted off its stilts and carried away by waves brought ashore by Ike's Eye. He survived by swimming into the open water of Galveston Bay for hours until he found a large pile of debris, the remains of other homes from Crystal Beach, to shelter on. In all, an estimated 100,000 homes in Texas had flooded, and boats littered the shore. Galveston would be declared uninhabitable. In Houston, the theater district would flood. Roughly 2.25 million residents would be without power, and the city would impose a curfew for the next week. Area hospitals lucky enough to still have power saw an influx of patients for numerous reasons, many needing medication or oxygen which had run out. The Center for Disease Control would attribute 28 deaths in the Houston area to indirect effects of Ike, including illness and accidents such as carbon monoxide poisoning, fires, and deaths related to tree cutting. And just like as a PSA, for real guys, please, please, if you're going to run generators, know how to run them safely. Don't run them inside. Don't run them indoors. And if you need heat, don't light a charcoal grill inside. Okay? Oh, okay. Roads in Houston remained gridlocked for 2 weeks following the storm as a result of damaged or malfunctioning traffic signals. Highway exits would be clogged to bottlenecks, especially during hours of heavy traffic. Gas stations were closed for about a week with no power to supply pumps. Those that did have power would see long lines and hit or miss deliveries of fuel, causing even more headaches, with most places selling out completely shortly after receiving deliveries of gasoline. Adding insult to injury, the price of crude oil had jumped with the anticipation of damage to and delays from the many oil refineries that call the South Texas coast home. Similarly, long lines cropped up elsewhere in grocery stores, restaurants, and home repair stores following Ike's departure. After the storm, many residents of Galveston, the Bolivar Peninsula, and Houston that had remained to ride out the storm had stayed due to a number of reasons. A false belief that the hurricane was only a Category 2 and therefore not enough of a threat to warrant evacuating. Some remembered the evacuation nightmare of Hurricane Rita a few years before, and the storm's sudden right turn before it hit land, leading many to believe Rita had been a false alarm and that Ike would likely be the same story. And some folks stayed simply because they believed they had more time to evacuate than they actually did. Regardless, Ike remained the second costliest storm in U.S. history, just behind Hurricane Katrina, until 2012's Superstorm Sandy. Next up, I talked to my friend Brittany about her experience in Houston during the storm. In early September of 2008, Hurricane Ike devastated the Texas coast. With over 1 million evacuees and 100,000 that chose not to evacuate, I'm here in this episode with my friend Brittany, who chose to ride out the storm in Houston with her husband. Hey, Brittany, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
Doing all right, doing all right. So we're here to...
Really excited.
So we're here to talk some storms today, right? One in particular.
Yes. Hurricane Ike Eisenhower? Did they call it Ike?
Yeah, it was just Hurricane Ike.
All right. I just remember being very disappointed in my first hurricane. So,
well, see, you and I were kind of talking before we started really recording, and we were kind of talking about where we were in our lives at that point. And, like, I know I had just graduated from college and was working my first grown-up job, but I was still pretty much living at home. And I mean, I kind of remember the coverage of Ike in passing, but kind of what was your experience? Did you guys prep for it? Did you think it was going to be as bad as it ended up being?
You know, so my husband and I moved, we were not married at the time. We moved to Houston. My husband had gotten promoted with his then job, and, you know, I was just kind of playing the role of newly engaged, also a college student, albeit correspondence, and or I think I wanted to drop out. And I know you're like, well, I was a new graduate, and I was like, I wanted to drop out. I was over it. You know, and then I remember, I think we had been in Houston maybe 5 months. You know, we had moved, I think, in February of 2008. And, you know, Houston was just this big, wide opportunity. You had a little bit of anonymity. I didn't know a lot of people. I honestly can't tell you if I knew anybody when I moved to Houston. I was just, you know, was with Cake. We had been dating for a while. We were newly engaged. And he asked me to move to Houston, and there we went. And then I think Ike happened in September. And actually, the funny thing is we got married in Oklahoma about 2-3 months later. Two months later in November.
Right, because it's funny because you and your husband share an anniversary with me and my husband.
Yes. Yes, albeit we are in the past and you are the future. 2008 in your what year?
Yeah, we were 2012.
Oh, okay. Ooh, so 4 years into the future. What was the question again?
So, kind of as you guys are like watching this develop, was it something that was really, I mean, no pun intended, was it something that was really on your radar, or was it just kind of like, yeah, whatever?
So we had lived in Houston for a few months, and, you know, I went to Houston, my husband said, you know, if you go with me to Houston. You will not have to work. You can focus on school, whatever it is you need to do. And I said, okay, cool. So we started our life, together in a new town. If any relationship is going to endure, it's those growing pains. And at one point I went back to Oklahoma for an entire month and planned what would be, our wedding. And when I came back, he was just like, you seem kind of depressed. You just got up and went to Oklahoma for a month. And I was like, well, he's planning our wedding. And he was just like, okay, maybe you should get a job. And I was like, okay. And
Real confidence booster.
I know, I was like, he's like, maybe you should get a job. And I was like, all right. And then I kind of just looked around. I wasn't looking for anything very serious. And so I applied at Home Depot. And I was preparing to just kind of get a part-time job, something to put a little cash in my pocket. And I remember this, that I had gotten the job, and within a week I was planning on going to my orientation. And Cake came home from work that day, and he said, hey, you should probably call your new job and you should see if they're actually going to have orientation. I said, oh, why would they not have orientation? And he said, well, there's a hurricane coming. And I was like, is that going to stop orientation? Like, is I didn't know
Hello,
what to
work.
expect. I didn't, you don't, I had no idea. If it's like a tornado, you can go back to work in 30 minutes. You'd be fine.
Right.
And so I called and I said, hey, I heard there's going to be a hurricane coming soon. Are we going to have orientation? And the manager at the time, he said, oh, yeah, as far as I know. He goes, give me just one second, I'll follow up on this. And he kind of put me on hold. And then he came back, he said, yeah, we're gonna have orientation, so we expect to see you on this day. I said, all right, cool. I said, well, I told Cake, and he's I think you should maybe forego this. Said, you're the one who told me to get a job. And then I told my grandmother, and my grandmother called me. She says, Brittany, are you going to come home? I think you should come home. And I said, grandmother, I have a new job that I'm going to start. And they're going to have orientation. I need to go, like, I need to be there. It's my job. And she said, okay, and I explained it to Cake. Cake's like, okay, we really didn't know what to expect. We planned a little bit, what was kind of normal, the things that you would get for a tornado was our best case scenario. The water, canned foods, things like that.
So
And go ahead, go ahead.
this wasn't like you guys sitting there going, okay, worst case scenario, it's like Katrina a couple of years prior where there's nothing. It's just,
Here,
okay, we're gonna have a party.
I had no idea. Like, I really couldn't fathom Katrina as a thing, like, I didn't know. I was still in college. I was partying when Katrina was going on. I assume, I don't know the concept of time. I don't know. I thought that was kind of the way it was described, in the news for Katrina, it was kind of a once in a lifetime thing. People hadn't really, I don't remember being so aware of a hurricane just ravaging a countryside, removing homes or any of those things. I have no idea what to expect. And I just thought, oh, we'll be without power for a few days, maybe, or we might not have running water. I just little things that I thought. And then I was just like, oh, okay. But albeit everybody started leaving Houston. They all started leaving. And I was like, well, I just got to get ready for this job. And albeit one day before I was supposed to go to orientation, like the day before, I'm sitting here getting those first day jitters of, ooh, my new job. And I get a phone call and it's, hi, Brittany. And I said, yes, this is she. And he's like, we're not going to be having orientation tomorrow. There's a hurricane coming, so we've canceled all of that. We've suspended everything. And I was like, okay. And I told Cake, and Cake was like, well, you just lost your window, because they had started shutting the highways down. Like, the roads were getting closed, and
So
I could not leave
was that kind of
Houston.
Well, was that kind of your first inkling that something was not right?
People say hunker down a lot. They say hunker down, and he was like, "Well, you lost your the roads are closed." Like, I was just, who just closes roads? And you know, the funny thing is we've had I-35 closed down, maybe once or twice a year now that we live in Oklahoma. Like, and it just, I'm like, do we just decide that it was okay to start closing highways down? You know, when did that become a normal thing? Like, oh, sorry, I-35 is closed. And
And so like nobody at his work is telling him, hey, you guys might think about evacuating if you've got someplace else to be, or if you're going to wait until this point, know what your hurricane evacuation route is, nothing.
If they did, they told him I knew nothing. Nobody talked to me. I had no friends. Nobody. I didn't talk to Cake was my lifeline, and he was preparing the store for those things. You know, I remember one of the very last moments when, like, the city of Houston shut down as well, especially, well, and I don't know where else, but in our little quadrant of Houston, like everything shut down, like all businesses were closed, they were boarded up. I started seeing where you couldn't get wood anywhere because everybody was boarding everything up. And like for us, we lived in a two-story townhouse. We were on the second level, and we don't own this, so we don't care. We didn't board up anything. But we had water, we had canned goods, we had lanterns, you know. Yeah, just we sat there and just, you know, we got what we could. You know, we didn't go overboard by any means. And then you started hearing about just everybody shutting down, and then nobody's going anywhere. Nobody's doing anything. And I think I was with Kate the last few hours before before their Walmart shut down. And my husband was the last person in the building. And then we were the first people in the building after everything subsided. You know, I think it
Wow.
was a day or two later.
Wow. So then the area where you were living in Houston, did you guys see floodwaters or did you see? Because I know Houston's kind of built on a system of bayous. And so anytime it rains, it floods.
You already know more than I know. We lived at Westheimer Road. We were about a mile and a half from the Galleria, and so we did not experience a lot of flooding. So we actually lived right behind the Walmart that my husband worked at, and there was a large retaining wall that separated Walmart from our apartment complex. And I think in around that area there were some little ditches, but we never had water come up that high. It was not like that. There was a significant amount of rain, and we actually had power until about 2 a.m. I was asleep when the power went out. Cake said he woke up, but I remember at some point, like, he was actually dozing off, you know, because he'd been working nonstop for the last few days. This is back when he was a salary manager, and he was working as many hours as possible to ensure that the store was prepared, the people were prepared, and everything was, you know, a full lockdown. It was as
Like
secured.
secure, yeah.
Yes, secured as possible. And I remember stepping out and watching the rain or the circle. I remember going to the side. I mean, rain already traveled to the side in Houston just because of the way, I guess, it's situated. But the way I remember stepping outside and just there being a lot of wind and just looking. I remember getting lost watching a plastic sack just swirling around in the air, and just these constant, you know, wind forces, and just kind of looking at it. And then I went back inside, you know, and just kind of laid there. We also before I finally passed out, you know, just going to sleep, you know, the anxiousness, we were just making a list of what would make What would make this hurricane better? You know, the things that you do, because there's no TV. We still had power, but you know, cable was out. And it's just like, it's like, what would make this better? He's like, board games? Board games would probably make this better. You know, more lanterns, you know, just those comfort things, something to pass the time. And you know, it was like that for one and a half days when everything, I don't remember, couple days it passed by, and then you start the aftermath, you know, the cleanup and all those things.
So then let's talk about that a little bit. You made the comment about things that you had kind of talked about. What would make this better? Knowing what you know now, would you ever go through another hurricane?
Well, I mean, I could if I have to. It's not my favorite thing to do. Because of where we lived, we were actually we lost our water. We did not have water. Ooh, cake is better at these timelines. I think we didn't have water for up to a week where we were located. So like, and unfortunately, Houston is very hot, and it is very, I get very uncomfortable. And I had ran some water in one of our upstairs bathrooms, and or actually both of them, and one of them kind of served as like my washing area because it was unbearably hot. I was so uncomfortable, and so I would just kind of sit in this kind of cold water, and that was kind of my relief for a little bit. I do it right before I was supposed to go to bed, quote unquote. We actually flipped our schedules, and we would sleep during the day and cake would work at night. And then we got electricity. Whew, I think 2 weeks later, 2 weeks later is when we got electricity back. But because of Walmart, I would actually get to experience air conditioning at night. I would go to the store with him at night while they were cleaning all of the bad food. And I would sit in a little room with a flashlight, and I would just read magazines while he was at work, you know, orchestrating the cleanup and delivering dumpsters. He was actually on site for when the first generator got there, and it did not get there for a few days because it got locked up on the highway, like on like in transit. The generator came really late. And then the issue you run into is that that generator was broken, and so another generator had to be shipped to our Walmart before we had sustainable power, like where it actually powered the store. And so that was
I feel like anybody that has ever worked retail is sitting over there nodding. That sounds familiar. That sounds familiar. But the food, that's something that has never occurred to me. You know, what happens when that store stays in lockdown for even a couple of days?
You know, and because of retail, you know, if something leaves a fresh product, if something leaves the cooling section or it sustains, the power goes out and the cooling goes on over a certain temperature, that is not usable food anymore. That is not allowed for consumption. And that's what ended up happening, is that it was a days of where they're just getting rid of food. They're getting rid of
Oh my
food,
God.
and they're having to throw it away. And the scary part is like that food is not available for consumption. And because there were other individuals in our area that did not prepare for this hurricane, at night, eventually they did have to call the police, and the police had to they had to kind of guard the dumpsters because people were digging in the dumpster looking for food. They needed
Well,
food.
and it's not one of those things where it's like, we don't want to give this to you. This is not safe for human consumption and will likely make you sick.
Likely, and also, who's to say that somebody's not going to sell that to somebody else, or you know, and then people are going to get sick from that, and who's not to say that's not going to create a riot? We went into martial law while we were there. You know, there was a curfew that was enforced. Oh man, when they were doing the cleanup, there were threats. There were people. Oh my gosh. At one point, Kate said that there were people in an apartment complex. They were drinking the water out of the pool because they
Oh.
had no water. They did not prepare for that. And then having to deal with the price gouging, people were selling cases of water for $30, $50 because people didn't have water. And just, if you got caught doing that, I think you got prosecuted. You got prosecuted if you were found price gouging like that, especially in the aftermath of a natural disaster.
Wow. And I think that's things that I don't think about, because a lot of the weather stuff that fascinates me is the things like tornadoes, where it's very fast and in and out, and then the recovery can start almost immediately, as opposed to like a long track hurricane where you're there for the duration, whatever that duration might be.
And that's the timeline that I didn't expect, is how long it was going to take. And it took so long for various areas because not everybody gained electricity at the same time. Cleanup didn't start immediately. You have to think about, like, this is a large metropolis, and some people are prepared to start putting the town, the city back together, and other people, they're not ready for that. You still can't, I can't account for, like, for us, that was a very big city, and I did not go out of my quadrant for a very long time. I didn't have the confidence to travel, being from a small town, and the largest city I'd ever lived in was Oklahoma City, and it's still a grid system, and we're all still Oklahoman, and if I get stranded somewhere, chances are I'm related to somebody down the road and they'll help me. And in Houston, I didn't have that. I didn't have that support network. And then all these people are now desperate people, do stupid, desperate things. And that's what you had to be on the lookout for, is there were some desperate people that were going to take advantage of that situation. And you may or may not be a victim to it. And I try to be a good person at the end of the day, but that's not to say that the person next door is going to be.
Yeah.
So, oh,
Very true. Very true.
I do it, but I think I'd also have more guns. Like,
Or you would want to like know your neighbors better. So it's like, hey, people right next door, you guys are okay. People at the end of the block, I don't know about you.
Saying that now, you're right. I wish we'd have known our neighbors a little bit more. And it's not that they were bad people, but they were also in dire situations. Maybe they didn't prepare as much. And if they're without, what are they going to do when placed in a scenario where they can take what they want and eat? It's, I'm not saying that people are going to do that, but there were threatening words. When we were going into the store, they had to have certain employees had to be security, essentially. They had to make sure that only Walmart associates were going in the store, to ensure that, nobody would, it's not that they were looting, but just to make sure that the safety of everybody involved in the rebuild of that store, it was imperative.
Right.
I think I wrote, I could be making this up. I think Cake hired a couple of people, just like, hey, we still need this to be done, because not everybody could come in. They couldn't make it to the store to be able to do that. Some of them had evacuated. Some of them had been shut down. You couldn't travel so far away from where you lived, because
Right.
either the roads were not available, or you couldn't make it through, that it was shut down or it was flooded. Just,
Or you had to be home before curfew.
yes, or you had to be home before curfew, and you kind of had to have an excuse as to why you were doing so. Like, if you had your name badge, so one time those badges really came in handy, is like, why are you out driving this late? I have to go to work. Well, most of the shifts actually started before dark, and they did not end until it was sunlight or just about sunlight.
That's smart. And for someone like me, this is stuff that it's never really occurred to me that you put desperate people in desperate situations, you have martial law imposed, what is it, dusk to dawn curfew. It's insane.
You know, I remember them talking about martial law, and to that point, it was just something I had read about in books, you know, in history books in high school and college, and you know that was how we were living at that time, and you know, at first he didn't want to take me with him to work, but I'm like, you're my only lifeline, like I need to be with you, and when they got threats. You know, I was like, would you rather me be here by myself while you're on the other side of that wall, you know, away from me? It was like, that's what you want for me? It was like, I'm scared. Like, I'm not used to this city yet. And that's what you want. He's like, all right, put your shoes on, let's go, you know, grab a bag. And then we went. And so we'd sleep during the day and then we would get up at night and then go into work. And he would I didn't walk around or do anything crazy. Like they were trying to put that store back together. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think there was a cave-in from the amount of water that went through the roof. I think there was some leakage and it went on top of clothing and other domestic things, and they had to clean that too.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, I remember it's one of my favorite things that Walmart associates do if you're really resourceful, is they take car batteries and they take these huge lanterns, and essentially that's how they power the lanterns, and they put it on a trolley, and as you work each one of the sorry, excuse me, as they work each one of the aisles, they're just moving that trolley. They have two of them usually. They're moving that trolley between aisle and aisle, and so you have a flood of people who are just stocking, moving, breaking down boxes, and when you finish the aisle, you go to the next one and you start on that one. And they would do that as they would get shipments in, trying to rebuild and reopen.
So then at this point, is the entire store dark?
Yeah, it was dark for a little because I told you the one of the generators, the first generator, it wasn't a good one.
Right.
And then the second generator, it was a backup and they couldn't quite figure it out. They had to, and then trying to get an electrician to come in and set that up and to figure out what's going on, that took time. It took a lot of time.
Oh,
And
wow.
you know, and also with some of the damage that the building sustained, some of the lights wouldn't work. And it was an older store, so it wasn't as well lit as you'll see some of the newer Walmarts.
Right.
So they're, you know, not as many skylights. One of the bonuses to skylights for Walmart is that it's less power, but this was an older one, so not as many windows.
And I'm not gonna lie, like I'm not a, I wouldn't say that I'm afraid of the dark because I know that there's, you know, nothing hiding in the dark. However, when it's dark and you're in a space like Walmart, I get a whole lot more open-minded about what
Okay.
could be out
Oh,
there.
oh, oh. If I could, I was, I don't know. It's kind of embarrassing. I was fresh out of ROTC, when we moved to Houston, and so I still kind of had some of those militant procedures in my head, and so when we were first on site. Cake and I went into the building and he was just double checking the security. He's making sure, was there significant damage? Where was this damage? He was that point of contact because our store manager was in Dallas. He evacuated.
Oh no.
So he and I are the first one in, and we're just making sure that everything is secure, that nothing crazies going on. And so Cake and I are just walking through. We have backpacks. We're just kind of double checking areas. You're right. In the dark, in a very dark old Walmart. It's old, but you're right. You're making up things. Ah, oh, man. You're making up things. Shadows are being cast with flashlights. And we're there. We're walking through. I'm like, did I see something? Did I see something? Hey. My six, you know, we're still going through these. We're trying to clear rooms and clear areas. And then all of a sudden, we hear a pop. And I was like, oh my God, gunfire. And I'm like, okay, good. You know, we're now like, he's like, hey, can we, like, oh, I don't know. We don't have guns. We need guns. Why the fuck don't we have guns? And then, and then it goes off again. I was like, oh my God, there's somebody in this building. What's going, you know, I don't even think I had a cell phone back then. I maybe I had a Pantech Duo, but what good is my Pantech Duo? Is yeah, fuck that. And so I'm just sitting here and I'm just like, we're trying to, but then we cakes is okay, it comes from this direction, you know, we're moving. He's like, okay, we need to wrap around, we'll get out of this building, we lock it down, like, no, whatever it is. Fucking cans of biscuits. It was cans of biscuits. They were exploding because the temperature was increasing. Fucking biscuits. Did I never tell you that? What did I tell you?
No, that's what I'm gonna call the episode, though, is fucking biscuits. Oh, that's insane. And see, my mind immediately would be like, zombies. There's zombies in here. There has to be.
Know what? When The Walking Dead came out years later, I don't know when The Walking Dead came out, but when The Walking Dead, that's what it felt like in Houston, you know. And what when Andrew Lincoln, what is his character say? When Andrew Lincoln is wa like riding a horse into Georgia on those roads that are just abandoned, like that's what it was like. There were areas that the streets were clear, nobody was going anywhere, because if you used all your gas, what, how are you going to fill it up? Nothing's running. And
Yeah, and
so
you save the gas for emergencies.
you know, assuming you can get out if those roads open. But yeah, that's what it felt like. And she's like, oh man, that could be Houston. I think when Cake and I started watching The Walking Dead, we said, oh, that could be Houston after
Yeah.
Thursday night. That could be it.
Oh my God. Well, I was gonna say, I think we're gonna go ahead and wrap this up and thank you so much for coming on here and talking to me, because I know we've been friends for, God, we've been friends for
Ooh, forever?
like,
2012, right? You got married that
yeah,
year.
I was gonna say, I'm pretty sure that we've been friends for almost 10 years.
Over, no, I would say more than a decade. At
Oh
least a
yeah.
decade, easily.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because Billy came to work for you and
Oh, you know what? Maybe almost 10 years. You're right. I didn't, I assumed we were friends when we moved to Ponca, but we weren't. We
I was
didn't
gonna
know each
say
other for a little while.
at this point we've just been friends forever.
Forever, forever. We're adults now, so I mean, these are the relationships that I think we're going to remember
Right.
longer.
But yeah, like I said, thanks for coming and talking to me about Hurricane Ike and not evacuating, whether it was your choice or not. And we'll get you back on the show for something else, because I'm
Sounds good.
sure the insane weather that we have in Oklahoma can't make up its mind. I'm sure eventually we'll have another story to tell.
We'll have a hurricane, maybe, you know, you don't even know what to expect in Oklahoma anymore.
Was gonna say, God, this year, what have we already had? Record-breaking freezes, snowstorms. Have we had tornadoes yet this year? I think we've had a couple, but not
Not
like,
here, not here.
I was gonna say, not like, not a lot. Well, we did have a funnel cloud in Blackwell a couple of weeks ago because everybody in my office lost their shit, and I was like, calm down,
O'clock.
calm.
It's 1 o'clock. It's
I was like,
fine.
it's a funnel cloud. At best, it's a land spout. I'm not going to get my panties in a twist until we actually start seeing some like supercell motion.
No hunkering down as of yet.
That's
But no,
right.
thank you. Thank you so much. I'll come on anytime. Anytime you want me.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Thanks for joining us today. If you're interested in historic storms that have affected the Texas coast, I highly recommend the podcast Hurricane Season, put out by Houston Public Media. It's an 8-part look at how hurricanes and other flood events shaped how Houston fared during Hurricane Harvey in 2017. And their episode on Ike is fantastic. Our August episode is currently up for voting on the Facebook page. The choices are the Midwest and Oklahoma floods of 2019, in which a submarine in Muskogee broke its mooring, and the Anderson Creek fire of 2016 that was the largest wildfire in Kansas history. As always, my inbox is open for stories, comments, what have you, corrections. And that's caughtinthefury@gmail.com. You can also submit a story via Google Forms, and I will post the link for that. And I now have access to voice messages through Anchor. So if you want to tell your own story in your own words, using your own voice, I got a link for you. So just keep that in mind. Next episode will drop on the fourth Tuesday of August. So tune in then to hear the results of your votes. And we'll see you guys next time.